You're listening to a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find other episodes of The View and to subscribe to this podcast, visit questformeaning.org/VUU.
Good morning. I'm Meg Riley with the Church of the Larger Fellowship here in rainy Minneapolis, where it thundered and lightninged all night. And I just love rainy days, rainy Thursdays. That just has such a great sound to it. Let's have other folks introduce themselves, and then we'll get to our special guest today.
Hi, I'm Joanna Fontaine Crawford. I am in Austin.
I'm Aisha Hauser, and I'm in Seattle, Washington.
I'm Bob LaValle, and I'm in beautiful Buffalo, New York.
And we let Bob out from behind the chalice today, so we didn't have an all-girl review. And our special guest today is Tandy Rogers from the UUA, who does all the cool creative stuff, but that's not her actual title. It's, let me guess, it's like one of those that sounds like it's from The Beacon, you know, Director of Innovative Failure? Now, what's your title?
Innovation and Network Specialist.
There you go. And Tandy's going to tell us all about geeky things and cool things, and so we'll have a conversation. But first, Joanna, what's up in Texas?
You know, I'm so tired of all of my conversations beginning that way. Every morning I wake up thinking, feeling like maybe this will be the day when Texas doesn't embarrass me, but that day is not today. Yes, so it sounds like a pretty brilliant high schooler in Irving, Texas, Ahmed Muhammad, created apparently in 20 minutes before his bedtime, made a clock, and with some wiring and a solder iron, and apparently this is something he does. He likes to invent things. And he took it to school, showed it to his engineering teacher. His engineering teacher, I believe, said, hey, that's pretty cool. By the way, you might not want to show this to anyone else. And then apparently he was sitting in English class, and it made a noise, and his English teacher wanted to see it, and he showed it to her, and the next thing he knew, he was being interrogated by four police officers without his parents present, which as a mom, put in handcuffs, suspended for 3 days from school, and because they felt that it was a bomb, even though apparently he kept saying, no, it's a clock.
I read that they were saying he should have said more than it's a clock, and I thought if I were surrounded by police officers, it's a clock might be a lot to be able to say.
And what else would you say? It's a clock. I made a clock. That would be hard for me, and I'm in my 40s, for a high schooler. Anyway, so thankfully, the news got out about this, and people around the country are responding. Little no-name people like Barack Obama, who's invited him to the White House, and I believe I read that MIT has offered him something, a scholarship or something, so it is good seeing that response. And of course,
the question... Did you start with the high schoolers? Is that how it came out? I was really curious how it turned into an internet story. It must have been people at the high school, right?
Right. I think someone took a picture of him in handcuffs. Anyone who's seen the picture, kind of this stricken look on his face. I don't know if this is true. I read somewhere that he has a sister who asked the person who took the picture to share it. And I think that it just went from there. And I mean, because the story is really just so ridiculous. Everyone wanted to talk about it.
It is. I will say that I saw not you, but another Texan had the story on Facebook talking about Texas. And I said, that could happen in Minnesota. That could totally happen in Minnesota. That could happen anywhere.
Yeah. That absolutely.
Minneapolis, but in the suburbs here, absolutely. I have no illusions that only Texas is that Islamophobic and terrified of any name that looks like it might even potentially be related to Islam.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, look at everything that happened with the Boston bombers, the two brothers, you know, and what happened once they realized, oh, okay, they're Muslim, and, you know, it can happen anywhere in the U.S.
Aisha, are you on mic to say something about this?
Yeah, but it wasn't important. It was just, yeah, I mean, it's just the whole, and I was thinking last night about why automatically all these teachers jumped to calling the police, and I realized he's a freshman, so they didn't have a relationship with him, and they hadn't gotten to know him, and they just saw two very Muslim names with one little brown child, and he was little. That's also what struck me. He's a scrawny 14-year-old. I say that with affection, being the mother of a scrawny 14-year-old I just sent off to school, and so I said, oh, so they're, talk about assumptions, right? They automatically went to, he's parading a bomb around and calling it a clock. And even the explanation from the police, the statement they made is, you know, like you said, they kept asking for elaboration. And I'm like, what more exactly could you say except it's a clock? So it was very bizarre. It was almost like The Onion.
It really was, and they still haven't apologized, at least when I was reading about it this morning.
No, and the school sent out a horrible letter right after it happened to all of the parents, basically saying, we had this thing that we thought was a danger, but we've taken care of it. It really wasn't a danger. But, you know, yes, yay, you've protected everyone from a clock created by a freshman. And I think definitely that the big issue here is the Islamophobia, but I'm also curious about how much the, if you want to call it nerdophobia, but we've created this, ever since Columbine, this kind of picture of the nerd who in people's minds must be a social outcast who is, you know, diabolically plotting something. And we see it in fiction and sometimes in reality. And I think that this has become this other little thing that you combine the two of them and everyone's big fears, right?
And we also fear intellect. I mean, that's part where all this is going. There's a fear right now of scientists, of people knowing things. It's really quite, it's almost dystopian in nature that, you know, if you know how to make things and you're smart and you're a scientist, well, clearly you're up to no good. And it's all together. I'm glad you brought up that point, Joanna, because I agree.
Yeah. Well, it's particularly horrific that it's happening in the school. But I have to say, too, like, as a guy who spent a year in Afghanistan detecting bombs and looking at bombs, the cops, when the professionals came, they should have been able to tell in a second that it wasn't a bomb, because there's things that these devices have, and, you know, it's even an entry level person like can know right away. So why did it continue beyond that? That part is really concerning.
Yeah, well, I think it says a lot about the fact that they don't actually know what bombs look like. And I know I saw a post by a scientist who said this is all based in this sort of like Wile E. Coyote thing that we've always seen on the TV show, or MacGyver, right? We've always seen it in all the TV shows. There's always a clock, and actual bombs, you know, or at least anything made after 1950, that's not reality.
Well, the larger thing, to pull this back to the new Jim Crow, you know, the part of the reason the new Jim Crow is so effective is that we give law enforcement people, you know, policemen, frontline policemen, a huge amount of discretion in how to make arrests or who to consider a threat. And then once someone's in the system, that discretion goes away with all the mandatory sentencing and all that too. So It really is a piece of, an example of the larger system that leads to mass incarceration of, you know, of people of color too.
Well, back in D.C. after 9/11, you know, like any time you'd try to park in a parking lot that was related to a federal building, they'd search your car. And my mother was getting cancer treatment over at the NIH, the National Institute of Health. So every time we went there to get treatment, they would search the car. And I remember my father said, "Your Wile E. Coyote made me Think of it, Joanna. My father said, unless we had something that looked like a cannonball with a lit fuse coming out of it that said B-O-M-B on the side, they would, you know, they would just never find it. And it, we are all vulnerable. That's true. But exactly as Bob said, that kind of behavior just makes us more vulnerable, not less. Well, Aisha, what's up out in your neck of the woods?
Well, my son went to his first day of high school today after a seven-day strike. I'm not even counting. I don't even know. But the Seattle School District, one of the largest in the country, definitely the largest in the state, were striking. And the political activist in me was at war with the parent in me who just wanted my kid to go to school. I cannot lie. So he's actually thrilled. And the school I'm sending him to is an alternative learning public school. And the youth service last year at East Shore Church, Unitarian Church, had one of the youth talk about how egalitarian his school was and how he was respected. And I'm like, what school do you go to? So I asked him at coffee hour, and he said, Nova in Seattle. And I said, I live in Seattle. And so my son, one of the offerings there is immersion Russian, which really excited my son to no end. And he does not know Russian, and so he expects to know within about 3 months fluent Russian. So I'll keep you posted on that. We're doing well.
So how did this strike get resolved?
So it was actually quite brilliant. So one of the local radio stations was breaking down the strategy of the Seattle school teachers, and apparently they used the blueprint of the Chicago school teachers years back. And what the Chicago school teachers did was not only ask for pay raises, but also ask for things that appeal to parents. So that's exactly what the Seattle school system did. So they were asking for longer recess. They were asking for changes in disciplinary codes, which I do think they were very stupid. There was a whole list of things that really they collaborated and worked in partnership with parents. And so people were genuinely, for the most part, incredibly supportive of the teachers because it was a holistic approach. And so they were really genuine when they said this isn't simply about money. It's about creating a better environment for the children and the teachers. And so it was really quite a brilliant strategy. They had asked for 18%. They got 10. They did get the mandatory 30-minute recess. And so my husband and I, my kids have always had 30-minute recess on the East Coast. So he goes, how is it not 30 minutes? I mean, that's the minimum they should be getting. I said, apparently they weren't getting 30. So they did get some big wins, and they're pretty excited. Everyone's pretty excited.
That's great. In Minnesota, they have recess/lunch. So Gia came home with ketchup all over Gia's mittens, and I was like, what is with that? They put the kids in, young kids, into their snowsuits, their mittens, and everything, and have them eat lunch that way. I mean, what is wrong with this picture, you know? So, yeah, I think, did they talk about test scores at all? Was that?
Oh, that was the other thing, and I didn't read the maybe, I don't know if Tandy, Tandy lives in my neck of the woods. I don't know if you've read exactly. I'm not sure where they, because that was one of the other sticking points is how teachers get evaluated and mandatory testing. And teachers were actually, last year there was a big revolt. I was a part of that I opted my son out of the standardized testing. And there was a significant amount. One high school had an entire grade sit out. I'm not sure what happened with that. I'm imagining that the teachers must have won something with that and not have the testing as part of their evaluation. But I think there's federal mandates with that, so I'm not sure how that was reconciled. But, you know, it's fun living in a liberal city where there's Black Lives Matter signs everywhere, Bernie Sanders, and we're all opting our kids out of testing. I mean, it's definitely – I've never lived in a place quite concentrated on people who are like-minded. So it is – it's fascinating. Still got a lot to learn with race, though. I do have to say race relations aren't the best. However, with other stuff, it's pretty extraordinary.
Minneapolis is like that, too, a liberal city with just horrific disparities in arrests and sentencing and all kinds of employment. A thing just came out today that said that in Minnesota, the economic condition for blacks went down just this past year, 5%. So while the recovery is happening for white folks, the black folks in 1 year that went from a median income of, I think, $31,000 to $27,000. And we're below Mississippi now in the median income for blacks. I mean, we're like number 45 out of the states and D.C. and Puerto Rico. And yet people keep talking about what a great place it is economically. And it's like, yeah, if you're white, it really is. It's like, you know, two worlds.
There is an interesting initiative going on here in Seattle that I hope gets more national attention. There is a grassroots effort to create Africa Town. So we have an international district. We have Little Saigon, I think, and Chinatown. And so there's a concerted effort to create a neighborhood, not create, to designate a neighborhood in Seattle, Africa Town. And so I'm in support of that and hoping I can be part of that effort because I think it's a great idea. And there is no such place anywhere in this country.
That's for sure. Oh, that's really interesting. Keep us posted on that. Bob, what's up in Buffalo?
Well, I think thinking about Joanna's comments about it could happen anywhere. Here in Buffalo, in New York State, the allegedly liberal Northeast, there's a gentleman named Carl Palladino who is a real estate developer. He's a billionaire, and he's on the school board here. And he's one of those guys who is overtly racist. He's been busted sending out emails of, you know, like pictures of Obama dressed as a pimp. He was recently on the news saying, ranting about the damn Asians who are taking spots away from white kids at the state university, which is just not true. But he also, as a real estate developer, he's heavily reliant on tax credits through a system called the Erie County, which is our county, Erie County Industrial Development Agency. And just yesterday, he got denied getting a tax credit for a project because, and the people who voted against it said, I can't vote for a racist. I mean, I can't support economic development for a guy who has these views. And it was really, it was a nice moment for Buffalo, which has really got, boy, and, you know, talk about a mixed news day. The census reports, probably the same ones you saw, Meg, came out. Buffalo is the third poorest city of its size in the country, and about a third of the children of color, third of black children are growing up in poverty in the city. Half the Hispanic children are growing up in poverty in this city. And you know, everyone's bubbling about all the economic development and things going on because there is some vitality, but it's really for white people. So it's our whole country. It's our whole country.
Yeah, it is. We are Texas. Yeah. It's really true. It's really true. Well, speaking of statistics, which several of us have talked about today, we have the UUA's resident geek with us today, Tandy Rogers, who can really just analyze a mean statistic and make it interesting and fun. So, Tandy, tell us, like, this title that we have today, Correlations and Covenants, I was like, correlating what? Like, what do we even bring us into your little world? Tell us about
it. Well, the word corollary is, or correlation is, something I use constantly because that's the kind of data that I have is you can't make, because 30% do this, then that means for sure that this do that. No, it's just a corollary. It's something to pay attention to. And the title Corollaries and Covenant come from, I'm not interested in data that's just interesting flat by itself. I want data that's going to make us stretch and break down our assumptions and help us be more clear with who we are. So like when Bob said, you know, a third of the kids in Buffalo, the black kids in Buffalo are below the poverty system. You can create like a pie chart and you really can't turn away from that. You know, it's 30%, half of Hispanic kids in Buffalo are below the poverty. So those kind of stats are the stuff that I'm really interested in. For instance, a lot of the mid-sized, I haven't done the stats on this, but it feels like a lot of the leaders that come to the UUA or to a national or even a regional district level, cluster level, are from more mid-sized, larger congregations. And so we bring that assumption that, oh, everybody's, all the congregations are like us, when in fact, two-thirds of our congregations are 160 members or smaller.
Wait, let's pause on that. Two-thirds.
Yes.
Two-thirds of our congregations have less than 160 members.
That's what I'm saying.
That's profound.
Isn't it? Yeah, so then it kind of makes me go, okay, well, what? Then what's our service delivery? And this is where the covenant part comes in. If our point of the association is that we're better together, and then we come together to pool our resources to be bigger than ourselves, kind of like what we do when we come to a congregation, then it behooves us to really know who we are, and then how are we serving each other to be larger. So, and this is what I have found so exciting.
Can I ask a follow-up question to that, Data, just before we move on? Do you know what percentage of the roughly 200,000 people are in this?
Oh, see, now I wish I could have. I should have thrown you some PowerPoints with these graphs. I will blog about it soon on Growing Unitarian Universalism blog, and put that data up there. I know. Oh my God, I love pie charts. I wish I had a dry erase board. I'd quickly, make you these things. My office looks more like an art studio with a little bit of room for work, because I always feel better when I can see stuff and get messy with it. So. So you asked about members. So that's the congregations. So if I did a pie chart of the members, and I use, people always ask, why are you seven different categories? If I were Richard Nugent in church finance, I'm going to use, I think they use four categories for the size categories of, if you are this size and you pay fair share, fair compensation is this much. In my work, I primarily crunch data so that congregational life staffers can do their job more effectively, for that kind of impact. So we see congregational life and see it. And when you're working with congregational life, there's really seven different sizes that act differently. And there's nuances, but they act differently. So I use the seven different in my data. So if I made a pie chart of the number of members in each of those, it's almost even. It's almost a perfect pie chart, which kind of blows away, because, again, our assumptions that I've heard over and over is, oh, all of our members are in the larger and mid-size, and that's not true.
Can you say that again?
Yes. So in the pie chart, if I have seven different categories of congregations, so there's – I'm probably going to mess this up. I'm pre-coffee.
Very dangerous.
I know, right? Oh, my gosh. Okay, so if there's 0 to 60 – 61 to 160, 161 to, that can't be right, 300 to 400, because you know what I'm doing there, 300 to 400, 400 to 550, and then 550 larger. Oh my God, I got it. So those are all the categories. And then, so if I throw up where are our members? So not just congregations, but the number of members, it's even. And that just counts.
The top category is 550 and larger.
Well, Smalek, which, Meg, what does Smalek stand for? Smalek.
Senior ministers of large churches.
Large churches, yeah.
Thank you. Their category that they like is 550 and larger.
Okay.
But the church literature says that actually 600 and...
But yeah, 800.
Okay, I may have messed up that one. I don't do a lot with large churches except provide them data,
which is very important for large churches. Joanna, you got a question?
Yes. So Live Oak Leadership and I have been studying this book I really like called The Myth of the 200 Barrier, and in it the writer contends that that membership numbers nowadays are not as important as what he calls ASA, average Sunday attendance.
Yes.
Any opinion?
I have an opinion on that. Let me tell you if I got an opinion. Okay, so I'm going to tell you a story. Way back when Bill Sinkford was president, I was on his growth team, and this is when I got really excited about numbers. He and I would sit and totally geek out over pizza. So, why was I telling that story? He said, so numbers. We were looking at what numbers, and we realized that there was that kind of body of knowledge really growing of that the average Sunday attendance. Well, at that time we were just beginning to ask for average Sunday attendance. And being a religious educator to my core, as my core identity, I was paying attention to the RE numbers. Now, when I worked on that committee, I was serving the Pacific Northwest District. And I knew our numbers in and out. I knew our congregations like I know my family members. And so when I looked at the RE numbers, I'm like, okay, I know these are off because I just visited there and I know it's like double that, or I know that there's really only four children there. And so I went back to my own people and said, okay, what the heck's going on? In the congregations with under 160 members, so I'm going to use that general, their numbers are almost always, always, always consistently off. If you've got a professional in the position that counts those numbers, then the numbers went up. But if they were a new leader, they often would just cut and paste whatever was before. So that number was really unreliable. So I went and rallied. I organized. And we did a quick outreach to congregations to make sure that their numbers were correct and said, can you really check these? And the numbers were way different. And so we would do that for 3 years consistently until they knew that it really mattered. And now I feel like we can trust just as much as the adult membership what the religious education enrollment is. Now, with average Sunday attendance, people are still like trying to wrap. It's like, what do I count? Who do I wait? What if we've got two services? Do I got all that kind of stuff? So it's really soft data. It's still soft data. Actually, this is honestly, it's all soft data because it's congregations are reporting, but it's the best we got right now. So a long way to say yes, average Sunday attendance, and we can't trust the number yet.
So Tandy, I want to jump in because one of the things it's considered a large congregation.
Yes.
We're not quite 600. However, I'm going into my third year, and one of the things that I noticed pretty quickly after I got there is we're already a full week faith church. We have four buildings on our campus. We actually have five, but one of them is used as to help women in transition, homeless women in transition. So we have four buildings that we use. That campus is used 7 days a week. We have climate action, we have social justice, we have RE, what's interesting is I just did in gathering, and we don't have a minister right now. We're a large church without a minister. We won't have one for another few months. So for all intents and purposes, I'm the religious professional. So what I told the congregation was during the homily on Sunday is, I think East Shore is the future of Unitarian Universalism. We are connecting people to each other. And here's another radical thing we did for a large church. We went from two worship services to one, and the second hour is reflection and action. So there'll be opportunities for all-age connection, whether it's RE, there's multi-generational activities, there's going to be an opportunity for folks to come back into the sanctuary and talk to whoever the worship leader is about the theme and what came up for them. We're having Robin DiAngelo come in. She's does amazing white ally work on October 18th. I'm doing a plug there. So the average Sunday attendance, I wonder about I'm actually seeing and living the full week faith and really inspired by that model. So I do think, and I think also I wonder if that's region dependent, if it's different. Because Sunday morning we have soccer, we have, it's not the South. My understanding is there's less things happening Wednesday evenings and Sunday mornings, and that's not the case everywhere else I've lived. So
except for some of the larger.
Talking about Asia, about moving beyond counting worship as.
That's what I'm talking. Thank you. Yeah, my circular way of saying, Sunday morning attendance is because one of the things that happened at East Shore is we'd have about 30 or 40 people on campus that wouldn't even walk into the sanctuary. They'd be getting ready for a forum. They'd be in the RE building teaching. They'd be just hanging out with each other, having coffee the whole morning. And I think that's a good point.
Well, and the average Sunday attendance, it's not worship attendance. It's the average Sunday attendance. And we've encouraged, there's some congregations that meet on Saturday, or their big day that they gather is Wednesday. Okay, then to count that day. Count the day that is your big gathering, and it's everybody in the building, or campuses, or if you're multi-site camp, buildings, campus, whatever your gathering is. But you touch on, Asia, I think what the two big questions for Unitarian Universalism, and probably other religions too, but I'm only going to focus on us, are what does it mean to be a member in the 21st century? And I'll get into why we're really having that conversation at the board level. And then what does it mean to worship in the 21st century, to gather as a people? What is it you gather for? What is your big purpose? And that's a whole show unto itself, isn't it? When Jim Key came on, and I love working with him, he and I geek out on numbers, because I know that I'm going to give him some numbers. He's going to throw me back a, a hardball question. I'm going to have to go back and massage the numbers some more, look at things differently from different angles, and then he's going to do something with it. I mean, how precious is it? You know, my colleagues in other religions, I did a presentation at the Faith Communities Today Consortium, because our return rate on the latest, it was awful, this big, long survey that was a conglomerate. It was all the different religions had to come to consensus to these things, if you can imagine. So all these big questions, some of them have been consistent for years, and some we added this year. Our focus was young adults. Our return rate was over 50%, which, and I'm still pushing. I'm like knocking on doors of the ones who haven't submitted their surveys, because I would need to know who we are. And most are like all excited if they had close to 20%. And they said, what the hell is going on with you? Now, Meg is of the assumption that it's because you use love, you know, we love our opinions. And it's true. But I was at a gathering at General Assembly. This is when the survey was really live. And I was with the administrators, and I mentioned the survey. They're like, oh, we hate that survey so long, blah, 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 blah. And I laughed. I said, I am so sorry. Like, wait, that was your survey? I said, yeah. Like, oh, well, we're going to go do it. So the thing about us also is we're hyper-relational, and I think that speaks to our covenant. I have so much hope. I don't have the stats on this survey, so I'll have to come back and tell you that. So Jim is also somebody who's going to use it. So when he first came on, Stefan and I had just started the growth office, and so he came to me and said, I want to know what's up with, you know, we haven't, Ginny Porter said that we haven't had new congregations in so long, what's up with that? I said, well, we've got over 60 emerging congregations in the hopper, so something's coming, right? And he goes, wait, well, how long, can you go study those? Give me a snapshot of who they are. And in that process, we found out that many of them have just been lagging in that. And when we asked them, why not? They're like, well, we don't really have what it takes to be a congregation, but we want to be a part of the UUA. So brought that information back. The other thing I learned of them is that more had Facebook pages than covenants, covenanting documents or practices. And when I said covenant, most had no idea what the heck I was even talking about. And so I said, what is your relationship to Unitarian Universalism? They would go on and on about the principles. And I'm like, oh, I just wanted to like bang my head on the table. I'm like, those are lovely, but that's not what makes us Unitarian Universalists. They're really not that unique, people. I went to an ecumenical summit. So it's like covenant. And so I got permission. I asked Teresa Cooley. I said, can I update the application to be a member of the UUA? And she's like, well, sure, it needs to be updated. And so I added covenanting documents that in order to apply to be a Unitarian Universalist congregation, you have to show us what's your covenant. How are you gathering? How are you going to behave, right? It was a game changer. Oh, my gosh. The applications of the five congregations that we welcomed in this year were beautiful. We read them at the board meeting, and people had tears. They're just, it's a game changer. So the other thing that was a game changer is Jim and James Snell from the board.
Pause before you go on to the other game changer.
Yes.
First of all, I'll say we're about halfway through.
Oh.
And today we're talking to Reverend Tandy Rogers at the UUA, talking about corollaries and covenants. But I want to go into covenant a little bit more before you move on. Say, what was such a game changer? I mean, tell us some of the content of what you're talking about. What were people crying about? Say more.
Prior to asking, and by the way, and I'll get to this in a moment, but the covenanting community application also asks for your covenanting documents. Actually, it's a more stringent application than the membership, I think. The membership application prior was very administrative. We asked first, what are your bylaws? And I just like, oh my God, I'm sorry for any bylaw geeks out there. I want to know how you're going to love each other. And if I can't read that in your bylaws, I really don't care about your bylaws. So I want to know what your purpose is and what lights you on fire and why did you gather in the first place and what love letter are you going to send to the next generation, because this isn't just your congregation. This is something living beyond you. So, the game changer was shifting congregations, forming congregations, new ones, into thinking this is administrative to you. This is like you declare yourself as a religious community, and there is no going back. and you declare yourself part of a religious community that is asking to be part of something even larger than that, you know, the big one. And so, like, for instance, I'm blanking on the name, shoot, it'll probably pop into me, but one of the congregations really struggled. They handed in first the UUA's covenant, or I shouldn't even call it a covenant, because what we have right now is not really a covenant, but I think the board is paying attention to that, and I think you're going to see something at General Assembly in the next couple of years about recovenanting as a people, as a larger people. So the the congregation sent that in, and I'm like, no. So I sent Dori Davenport, who's a religious educator on our Congregational Life team, and I say religious educators like to the core. So she coached them and worked with them, and they put together something that was kind of, they felt like it was clunky. It was true, but it was clunky, and they still needed to work on it, and we're all like, yes, that's what you start with. And then the artists and the poets and the musicians and the congregation got a hold of it and turned it into what is now their litany. And it's beautiful. And so this is like the corollaries and the covenant. It takes all kinds of people in congregations. There's the people that that see that the clunky stuff, let's say the clunky stuff on paper, that listen and pay attention and get the words kind of right. And then the people who trust it, and they're like, you know, I'm not going to wordsmith this. I'm going to trust the leadership. I'm going to trust the body.
Wait, I want those people. Those are the people I want right there.
Right? Yeah.
If they trust the leadership and they care more about the mission than the paper. Yeah, those are my people.
Yes, right? And then it takes the poets who are going to see it, the places that aren't word right, that sacred holy stuff. And so when I get out my art supplies and work with the data, I think that's where I'm kind of taking it. And that's what I see this process as really shifting, is I think we're finally coming in to being a religious people without apology. And I just think of our ancestors, and this is the covenant piece, I think of our ancestors, and I think that they would be proud of us. Now, you know, I don't mean to be all a little mishopeful on this, because here's the, you know, a third of our congregations are in decline. And so also, let me say, to be a member, part of the administrative pieces, you have to have 30 members. Now, 162 of our current congregations would not be able to apply right now because they don't have 30 members. And yet we still keep them on the rolls. And many of them, I don't even go down a rabbit hole there, but there's another 48 who have between 31 and 35 members. And, you know, anybody in the Congregational Life staff will tell you that's not really a sustainable number, unless you're doing something really missionally innovative. But when I look at the numbers, the folks who are on our rolls right now with, you know, 162, those 162, they're in decline. There isn't one of those on the group.
It seems like trajectory is the bigger data point, like whether you're a growing organization or shrinking. I'm still obsessed with this, the pie chart of equal slices, which is saying that we're a movement that has a lot more variety than the story we're telling ourselves.
Yes, and that's why I love the numbers. Yes.
I'm coming here as a seminarian. Like, what does that say about the future of professional ministry, in your opinion?
I find it exciting because there's so many different ways to be Unitarian Universalist, and there's so many different ways to be a minister. Especially with multi-site ministry, there's like models we're breaking of how do you share staff? How do you, get really creative with that? So I find it exciting, very exciting. Okay, so then I'll be quiet and take questions. But that
really means that, I'm going to jump in, I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
But that really means that emerging ministers like myself are really going to have to think about looking for the old model is not going to get it done in most cases.
No.
Like the conventional path of like pass the MFC, go into search, wait to get called by one of the three congregations you apply to. Like, is that going to work anymore?
We've got some lag time. I think we're going to have a split for a while. If that's going to work for some people and it's not going to work for some people. And then you're at a great congregation, learning congregation, teaching congregation to learn to sit in that, to learn to sit in that discomfort of, oh my God, I don't know what's going on. Okay, follow the mission. What's your plumb line? What's the, you know, and then you're going to know. Just sit in that. So the board looked at this, and I gave them some other reports. I looked at, I have a new congregation report where we looked at 1988 to 2013, that chunk of time of how are those congregations doing. And Jim and the board took all that information and realized that we needed another status of membership, another way to name relationality, that the traditional congregation, just like you said, Bob, is there's other ways to be. And so to honor that, they created, it had been named a lot of different things. They were calling it recognized communities, and the group said, wait, that doesn't speak to mutuality, and it doesn't speak to who we are. Can we name who we are? We are people who come together around covenant, which, you know, that makes my heart sing. And so somebody on the board challenged me on that, because at first we called them covenanted communities, and said, you know, a covenant is not a noun. And I thought about that. I'm like, wow, to me, covenant is like God. It's a noun and a verb. It's all of that. It's an ing, like godding. I like that better. So we came with covenanting, and the groups that we shepherded in, our first cohort, they said, yeah, it felt really right. It's like, that's what we are. We're a covenanting community. So I think I'll take questions now.
So I wanted to jump in with everything that you're saying is, you know, I learned a few things that I hadn't known. But where does multicultural growth come in? So the city of Bellevue is actually more racially diverse than Seattle, even. I think it's at 48%. Seattle's at 43%,
right.
I think.
Right.
East Shore is not representative in terms of demographics of even the city of Bellevue. Although, interestingly, the director of finance and the religious educator, myself, are both people of color. So there are two people of color. We're waiting for a minister who are leading the congregation, which is pretty exciting, actually, because we've done Beloved Conversations. We're working with Beloved Conversations and doing it still. But one of the things that I see is, living it, is the tension between, you know, what I'm comfortable with, and this is true, I think, as a denomination. Here's how we've always been: New England Protestant. What's with the like? Our music was hit it out of the park this Sunday, right? Because I was like, okay, you know, this, and so it was great. And then we were now doing feedback forms, and somebody said, let's not dumb down our music. And it was kind of a punch to the gut, because I said dumb, because we had fun music that wasn't steeped in 1700s. It's suddenly dumbed down. So it was like an immediate clash to me of,
oh my God, that
culture
is such a white thing to say, man.
What?
That is just horrible.
It's intellectual bullying is what that is.
Well, there was a big fight about that at the minister's gathering a few years ago, where it was called happy clappy music, which I thought was also really insulting.
Really insulting. It's cruel, actually, and so if we're going to, and I say the royal we, I know I say it, I want Unitarian Universalism to be inclusive and a container. You know, we need not think alike to love alike. However, it plays out in some. It does. It's not quite as easy to do on the ground, and so I'm wondering, Tandy, what kind, you know, where does that fit into your work?
As far as the data, I'm just focusing on the data now. I actually have a shirt that named all the different things that I do at the UUA, so my staff would know. I would know. But speaking to the data piece, in the Faith Communities Today survey that went out, we do ask for a demographic breakdown. The UU World asked for that, and it's self-identified. So that's, I'm curious to see if there's if it's parallel information. I mean, if it's similar information. We ask for whoever's doing the survey then says, you know, what percentage are people of color, what percentage are, and it breaks down different demographics. So curious as to what that is. I'm choosing, that will all come out in mid to late October. What I'll continue doing is choosing 100 congregations from different sizes and different places in the country. And then, because I've got their zip codes, do their community breakdown and see what that is. And so I'm very curious with that kind of information, for sure. You know, and then what do we do with it? Always know that then what? Then I think we're going to have some conversations to have with that. Oh, and then also laying down over that their growth numbers. So, you know, the growth number, the how many members, that's an indicator. That's just an indicator. But the other stuff are also indicators. And so I love to lay over all those different filters and then shift it a little bit and see what comes in.
So how do you anticipate, or do you anticipate, regionalization affecting the data? I'm in the southern region, so we've moved now to gift, so we're no longer paying according to member. We're paying according to, you know, budget. Do you anticipate numbers changing in some way?
And so for people who didn't follow, who didn't make that leap, what Joanna's talking about is so much of our membership is tied to how much congregations pay to the UUA is what's called their fair share. And the South has moved away from that. So then it opens up the question of what does it mean to be a member? And which I find very exciting. Interestingly, have not seen a huge shift. The South, well, that could maybe account for some of the growth you've had, but I think that is just solid growth. You've been growing. So it's not like you've been flatlining and all of a sudden growing. You've been growing, and it still is on that steady. 23% of our entire growth happens in the South.
Interesting.
You know what? Somebody's going to go count me to that. No, the most of our growth is happening in the South. The South has grown by 23%. That's what I meant to say. The South has grown in adult numbers by 23%. And we've not done that in the other region.
Since when? Mission Field, baby. Mission Field.
Right? In the last 7 years.
Is it the big churches that are growing, or is it the new churches? It's the whole thing.
That's what I find really fascinating. I'm like, isn't that interesting? It's not like one. So that's what I do also with the data. And also, this is less than an eighth of my job is the data. So I've got this list on my wall at home of all the different, like, I want to go deeper in these areas. I'm doing a study of the effects of endowments in the Northeast, in New England, because their budgets look really different than the rest of the country. So, right?
You know, I've been wondering about, last week I took us to Donald Trump. I'll just do it again. All roads lead to Donald Trump for me. But no, I think he represents something so frightening.
Yeah.
I mean, he really represents just blatant white supremacy. And I've been thinking about what his candidacy, the opportunity to speak out to the values. I mean, during the Bush years, when reading the paper felt like I was watching The Daily Show a lot of the time. I mean, I just felt so disoriented, which I see a lot of Americans feeling now, very disoriented with the Obama. And I really have compassion because I felt so, the meaning systems just really, the compass didn't work anymore. And I just think about times when churches have grown. And do you think that kind of cultural stuff is partly why the South is growing?
Yeah.
Is that it's already clearer there what we're heading into nationally?
I do, because the mission is like right there. That's what we know. Like, even with the extension program, the congregations who grew were the scrappy ones who really wrestled with the application and going like, what the hell are they talking about? We got to really think about this. And so they're like messy, but it's true. And it's like right there on the surface. And in the South, it's like that too. It's like it means something different than for like Aisha and I to be out in the Northwest claiming to be who the heck cares. In the South, it matters. You know, and that's why my allegiance has always been with the smaller congregations is, you know, I come from a small rural town in Ohio, and I think, my God, what would my life be like if I had a UU congregation?
Right.
My life would be so much brighter because I wouldn't have to have dealt with stuff that was so hurtful. And so I think that's what we're seeing is people getting really real with what it means to be UU. Those are the ones who are growing.
These kind of, you know, as a guy who was a UU in Boston and DC, where the culture on the street was not that different from the culture inside the sanctuary, it's really easy to take it for granted. And then go someplace where those churches that are truly an oasis, and Kandahar would certainly be an example of that. That's where the power is, or that is a place where there's power.
Yeah. So I want to find creative ways for, especially our larger midsize, to really connect with those. And I think that it could be a symbiotic relationship where, you know, you get, well, I think of Spokane as reaching out to, actually the congregations that are on fire now, Metau Valley and others, and they're getting energized by it. They're remembering, it's like, oh my God, that's right. This is life-saving. I mean, everybody can see that. And then the smallers get the advantage of being connected to larger resources. They just wouldn't.
Now, of the churches that are, you know, going down, are a lot of these smaller ones?
Yeah.
Because, you know, we've talked about this. I've reached out to some of those around here, and a lot of them are little family gatherings that really are not invested in changing, and they're going to, it would be too hard for them to actually do what they'd need to do to not die. And I don't see that they want to do that.
No.
Are there some of the small ones that are making a different choice and choosing to, I mean, we know Christiana, Willie McKnight, that congregation in Connecticut. Are there others that are saying, we don't want to die. We need to just, you know, open up, do something different, really live here.
Yeah. Again, that's why I get excited about the opportunities with multi-site, because some of them in the Doug Zielinski is doing some really good work in New England about how do you help people connect to each other and pool resources and pool vision and energy from each other to be something different on the outside but true to the core of what the ancestors intended. So I'm hopeful. Yeah.
So in a multi-site congregation, just going off on there, so the role of the when there's one ordained minister for multiple sites, is it ultimately about it's like sort of minister as lead developer of lay leaders, or
is there a way that looks? Oh, it can be a lot of different things. I actually have Scott Taylor on sometime. He's like the guru of he's our congregational life director, but also guru of multi-site. It just like there's so many ways to be UU, there's so many ways to be multi-site. The multi-site team I work with, we 2 years ago started studying the megachurches and realized their eschatology, their missiology, everything is like so different than ours. We can't just pick up that model and put it on. So we studied what's ours and what's theirs and realized that right now we've got four models that are pretty indigenous to Unitarian Universalism. And all different size congregations. So just like there's lots of ways to be UU, there's so many different ways to be multi-site as well. So anybody who's interested in talking about that more, give me a call. Yeah, give me a call. Happy to unpack all that with you.
She wants everyone to call her. That's a great idea. We had Daniel O'Connell on maybe 2 years ago to talk about multi-site.
Yes.
But it would be great to have, because I think Scott really sees the breadth in the ways that lots of different people are doing it.
Yeah, and now we've collected a lot of the stories, and we have, I'm calling up the spreadsheet in my brain. We've got about 75 congregations on our radar screen that the coaches are working with, the regional coaches.
75 of the small groups?
No, of congregations who are experimenting with multi-site in some form.
Is that right?
Wow. Yeah. I know, it's like, so many times people are like, well, that's just not going to take off. It's like, I got stats on that.
That's really interesting. I would not have guessed that.
I mean, everything from sharing thematic, like clusters who are sharing thematic stuff and then sharing lay leaders to people who are really sharing stuff. My own congregation, Tacoma, who would have seen that? We're sharing a staff with Vashon and then kind of flirting with, well, maybe we should check out themes together and see what happens. And I'm being sent over there to do a training for their people. They're sending people over to our congregation to do training. So it's like, oh my gosh. It's like congregational polity is like pew, new ways of doing it. It's awesome.
CLF is going to do an experiment with First Church Portland, Oregon in January, February.
Yes.
And to see if a local church, a bricks and mortar church, could really reach out in a meaningful way to people online, not just kind of live stream their services, but really, so we'll come in and kind of be bridging to the online community, and I have no idea, but I'm really interested, and our former intern, Terry Bernor, is now interning there, and we'll make it all possible. Let's hear it for the interns who do so much of this work.
Yay!
Hey, we're really close to the end, but I had one more question, Teddy. So you read a lot of covenants, and I'm curious what you've seen. What are some examples of really great covenants that really make the faith come alive for you?
Oh, wow. The ones that are really come alive for me are not just the ones that are covenants like this. I like to call those holy agreements of how are we going to walk together in the here and now in this moment. The covenants that bring me to tears are the ones that honor that we stand on other people's shoulders. And our a big part of our covenant is to make the way easier for those yet to come, to make it brighter, more amplified by love, and to hold it gently so that they can take it where we can't take it. Just like we took it where our ancestors couldn't take it, to be cognizant that we don't own Unitarian Universalism. If we are lucky, it will claim us. And when I see that in our covenants, I'm like, my money's on those people. Those are my people. Yeah.
Stewardship. That's beautiful.
Yeah.
Well, I know we don't have time to go into a long discussion about this, but back on that book that I told you I'm reading about, Myth of the 200 Barrier, one of the other big things that he talks about is that a small church and a large church are fundamentally different animals. A large church is not simply a small church with more members. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. Yes. That's my thought on that. They really are. And, with multi-site, we're bumping up against that of when does a large church and different sized churches come together. There's a lot of translating that needs to happen, and it's hard work, and it's religious work, and I think it's our right work. Yeah.
Well, Aisha, any last thoughts you wanted to speak?
No, this was excellent. And Tandy, so I do have one quick question. How do people, because I know you work primarily with congregational staff and then you invited folks to call you. Are people really, invited to call you and reach out to you?
Absolutely.
Oh, great.
I will always hook them up with their Congregational Life Regional Coach, but sometimes people just need to bounce some stuff off before they go. Or, I always feel like I'm like the Yenta at the UUA. People call me. It's like, I got this idea, but I don't know who to talk to. I'm like, I'm here for you. I'll help you with that.
Thank you. Thank you for your work.
You're so welcome. That's my joy. Thank you for having me. Oh, my gosh.
Well, we'll have
I love talking about this stuff. No one ever wants to talk about this stuff.
We'll have to have you back after you've got the data parsed from this big survey, and you
can
tell us more about what you've learned. When do you think that data will be parsed? In the new year, or what's your
look? The end of October, the report with the global of this is what we're seeing globally, and then as much as I could go down, and then throughout the year, I'm going to be pulling out different pieces and putting them up on the Growing UU blog.
You have one survey that went across faith groups. Is that what you said?
Yeah, and that survey, the larger survey, is going to be this time next year or next August, probably next August.
And that one will take longer. That will be really.
Yeah.
That will be very interesting.
Yes.
Even though such a huge percentage of our folks came through, we're so small compared to a lot of those other groups. It'll just be really interesting to see the general trends. And,
oh, I know. Yeah, we were already looking at kind of in August, we were all gathering, geeking out over just what we could see already. It was very interesting. It blew a lot of assumptions out, which is nice.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much for visiting. And next week we're going to have folks on to talk about the seven principles of Black Unitarian Universalism. Did I say that right? There are several names kicking around. Black UUism. Black Unitarian Universalists. Well, it's the folks who went to Cleveland for the Black Lives Gathering who were doing all kinds of really cool stuff. So we're going to have Reverend Alma Crawford and also Leslie McFadden who are just pushing out these UU principles, reflecting on Blackness, and we'll be talking about that next week. So,
awesome.
Thanks for being here, everybody.
This has been a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find out more about the CLF, visit questformeaning.org.